Welcome to the Spoolcast. Steven Anderson joins Jared Spool in a discussion about designing with data. Steven will be presenting one of the day-long workshops at the User Interface 18 conference October 21st through 23rd in Boston. For more information, visit uiconf.com. That's uiconf.com. And now, here's Jared.
Hello once again, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Spoolcast. And we have for you today very special dude, Mr. Steven Anderson, who's been doing a lot of stuff for UIE for many years, but this is the first time he's giving a workshop at one of our events, and this is the User Interface 18 conference where he's speaking on Monday, October 21st, on displaying data in digestible ways. Steven, welcome to the Spoolcast.
I'm glad to be here, Jared.
I'm so happy to have you. So you're giving this great workshop, and we were talking about it. And one of the examples that you brought up that you talk about is a website called HipMunk. Now, for folks who don't travel frequently, or maybe even ones who do but don't know about HipMunk, it's like chipmunk except without the C. It's a website for finding flights, just like there are any number of websites for finding flights. But HipMunk's a little different. Why don't you talk about what struck you about its differences?
Yeah, there are actually a couple things that are noteworthy about HipMunk. One is just the way they present your flight options back to you, where I would say the majority of airlines and travel sites will come back with this list of all your flight options. They chose to take something very similar to the Gantt model in project management, where you show basically bars and lines over time. They chose to use a model like that to display the flight results. And that's the first thing I make a comment of, and or that I would note about HipMunk. And from a cognitive perspective, that's really powerful because they're taking this information that when we look through this list, we're having to hold in our short-term memory, and they're actually putting it on the page. And so those things being, is there a layover? Yes, no. We're having to hold that in our memory when we're choosing a flight. If there is a layover, how long is it going to be? How many layovers are there going to be? Which airline is this? And all of that information is now in the page, so we don't have to, you know, take up space in our short-term working memory to think about that. We can just look at the visual and make a more effective decision. So that's the first reason I bring up HipMunk.
Yeah, it's interesting because the display visualization is so concise. I actually use HipMunk every week. You know, I'm always traveling. I'm getting on airplane every week, so I'm always booking a flight. And HipMunk is the first place I go because I can see the whole layout of the flight and all the other flights that I'm choosing between right there. They color code it by airline. And since I fly on particular airlines, I've memorized their colors. So my eyes now just go straight to those colors. And little things like US Air has this nasty habit of thinking that people can actually get off a plane, go across the airport, and get on another plane in Philadelphia in less than 30 minutes. And unless you are superhuman and can do what Superman does and fly around the planet to reverse time, you probably can't do that. Because if the first flight is late by even 10 minutes, there's no way you're going to make boarding on that second flight. Because boarding starts 30 minutes ahead of time. And you know, you'll get there just as they're closing the doors. I can tell immediately by just looking at HipMunk that those flights are not flights I want. And it's just, it takes me just a millisecond.
When you see it in text, it might say half an hour, it might say 2 hours, it might say 15, you know, if you're going through London Heathrow, but it's a line of text. But when you actually see that as a line, like we look at it just by the length of the line, we know, oh, that's a longer flight, that's a shorter flight. It's so much easier to process from a cognitive perspective. That's the first thing, the first reason I talk about HipMunk. The other is a really small detail that they rolled in that people always laugh at when I share it, but I think we laugh at it because we like it. And it's the label. It's this in the sort features that they have the usual suspects. So they have, you know, sort by price, sort by duration, sort by number of stops, you know, these types of things. But then they have this sort by agony feature that they've built or rolled themselves. I don't know what data they've rolled into it, but they've probably taken, you know, the on time, you know, status, historical record. They've probably taken things like the number of layovers, all this data. They've rolled their own sort by agony sort options so that the flights that are sorted at the top are supposed to be the least agonizing flights. So that's the other thing I point out. I don't see a lot of sites going the extra step to say, okay, what can we come up that will be a really unique data point? So rather than just pull the data that everyone else is getting, so in this case, all the same travel information and focus solely on the rendering, what else can we do with the data, with the API, to create something new and, in this case, of value to our users? Yeah, that's definitely the other feature that I point out.
Well, I think it's cool. If you look at the FAQ on the Hipmunk side, it says that it's primarily price, flight duration, and number of stopovers. And that makes perfect sense, right? If you can get a shorter flight to the same destination, you might even pay a little bit more for it. And it's always interesting to look down the list when it's sorted by agony, which is the default, and see a higher priced flight jump to the top and go, oh, yeah, of course, because it's a direct flight or it's shorter. What's interesting is it's just a little bit difference in price. If it's a lot difference in price, it goes down. It really seems to be smart. I think what they're doing with that is helping people make the default path be smarter decisions. I don't know if you knew this, but their hotels site, they just added hotels, and hotels let you sort by ecstasy.
That's fantastic. And yeah, hotels are a great way to create a data point like that, because there's so much, I'd say more so than flights, there's so much that goes into picking a good hotel. And a lot of it does have to do with personal preferences or conveniences, things that are harder to sift through and find. But, you know, when you go through a hotel site, that's the stuff we're usually looking for. You know, the reviews and did the room smell like cigarette smoke, or even though it was non-smoking, those types of things. So if you can figure out a way to surface that data, and I don't know if they do in that case, but that would be incredibly valuable.
So here's my question. When you hear about this and you think about it, you go, yeah, of course. Why would we do it any other way? Yet nobody else has done it any other way. And, you know, Hipmunk wasn't the first travel website. In fact, travel websites have been around for 10 years. So for more than 10 years, for 15 years. The question then becomes, why is it that Hipmunk was different? And I guess my interest is, if I'm going to want to think about changing the way my industry works, what can I learn from what Hipmunk has done?
Yeah, so I think, one, you can always say things are building upon what's come before them. So it's a progression, and Hipmunk was made possible by the Orbitz and Travelocities and Expedias of the world, and they were made possible by the Sabres of the world and so on. You can definitely go back that way. But I think if you look at any creative idea or any innovative idea, it's usually, there's a couple things that are happening. There's the intersection of things that shouldn't go together or that people wouldn't expect to go together. If you've grown up in the world of travel and you're looking at travel sites all the time, and that's all you look at, you're less likely to come up with, you know, a Hipmunk or whatever's going to follow Hipmunk, right? But if you start to look at all these other worlds, all these different ideas, you're going to say, well, why not do, you know, a travel site that's sort of like this? And so if you look at, I think I referenced earlier, it's kind of like they're taking a Gantt chart and bringing it to travel. And I think it's the intersection of those two ideas, a Gantt chart and travel information, that, you know, very well could have been the origins of that. And I think it's that intersection of two different things that we find behind most creative ideas or most inventions or innovations. So that would be one response. The other, and this is just common of teams and individuals everywhere, it's a much more fundamental idea, is this notion of functional fixedness. It's the simple idea that we start to get used to seeing things a certain way, and we say, well, that's how you do things. Why would you do it any other way? And so we become very focused on just how things have been done in the past. And this is something I talk about in the workshop and the talks that I give on this, where we tend to fall back on a lot of design patterns, things like a data table or a grid view, a list view, things like this, and say, well, if we need to push data to the page, you know, here's 4, 5, 6, you know, design patterns we can choose from. We never really step back and say, well, wait a second, what was the content that we were using a grid view to push to the page? Could that content have been served in a better way? And I think when you really dig into content, you know, we talk a lot about putting content first now, I think you'll actually find there are better ways to push or publish the content to the page than just, you know, using these conventional design patterns that we've become very accustomed to. You know, there's some design patterns that are fine for what you're publishing, but I would say in many cases, you can step back and say, okay, well, now that we have the time to take the extra effort and you know, look at the content. Is there a better way to serve this particular kind of content? There's an example I use where I talk about shopping for digital cameras. The same experience happened to me when I was shopping for a TV last summer. The tools that we have out there on most e-commerce sites for, you know, sorting and filtering and narrowing down our electronics options are really quite terrible. You know, we have basically these facets and things that can narrow our options down, but there are much better ways, I think, that we could design for, you know, sifting through 100 or 200 different electronics options where the differences are pretty minor, but we want to get to that best fit and that best match for our budget and our needs and the features we want. You know, at a very fundamental level, that's what I try to challenge people to think about, is there a better way to serve the content to folks?
So the part of it, like you said, is having a pattern library that talks about what all of our alternatives are. And out of that, I think there has to be some principles for which we can then choose which patterns are going to work best for us in this situation. And also, I think that that helps us understand the patterns in terms of, you know, this pattern's useful if you're trying to do this, but if you want to do this other thing, this other pattern is going to be more useful. When you're doing your work, are you building up libraries of this stuff? Do you like constantly collect what people do and catalog it? And
yeah, absolutely. And what I'm about to say is going to contradict everything I was just saying a moment ago. But, you know, we have these conventional UI patterns that we've grown accustomed to, maybe, you know, 24 or so that we commonly use. And the same thing goes for the visualization world, where there are several dozen visualization patterns. And people will offer these frameworks that'll say, oh, if you want to show relationships, here are the 4 or 5 ways to visualize relationships. If you want to show changes over time, here are the, you know, 7 ways to do that. And so you're starting to build out this pattern library for very specific types of information you need to show. And that's great. And that definitely broadens the palette that we're working from. But I actually like to not think about that structure and just, I throw all my inspiration, all the sites and the screenshots I find, I throw them in a flat file with no organization. And then when it comes time to, you know, when I'm working on the visualization or just a UI, you know, whatever it may be, I'll open up this folder and I'll just flip through all these things. And it's this, I know it's this almost random, not structured approach where I say, okay, here's the problem. Here's the content I'm working with. Here's the interaction I'm working with. Now let me flip through all of these patterns. And occasionally you surface a pattern that you would have never thought would have fit with the content, or you'll surface multiple patterns and kind of Frankenstein them together to create a new pattern. That to me is where a lot of the creativity comes around. So in the workshop, I talk, you know, a little bit about the common patterns, like if you want to show relationships, do this. But my bigger focus is, look, you know, think of creating a box for all of the inspiring ideas. Maybe it's a Pinterest folder or a board where you, you know, start pinning ideas, whatever it may be. And every time you find an interesting way to represent information, you know, add it to it. And then on the next project you're on, where you have some complex relationships to show, go to your inspiration board or your inspiration box and folder, just flip through that. And it's very much like, you know, going into your closet and trying on different clothes until you find the one that fits for that day. So yeah, in many ways, it's just saying add to your pattern library, but I don't think so much about structuring or organizing the library as much.
I think that that's an interesting idea, that you are just keeping them uncategorized on purpose so that you have that, I guess it's a freedom, right, that you have from it.
It is. And I guess what I found that it's definitely a challenge for a lot of folks. I think in a lot of areas, we want to know, okay, if this is the scenario or these are the conditions, what should I do? And I'm challenging people to say, well, I don't want to give you a prescriptive framework. I want to give you a more fundamental way to think about things so that you can come up with your own frameworks and your own responses. And that's definitely a hard idea. I mean, we're challenging people to come up with new patterns versus rely on previous ones. But I think at the end of the day, if we're going to really look at the interaction, the content, the experience that we want, I think this is how we should approach things, starting with that content-first approach and not the, I have content, let me fit it into one of these pre-existing molds, which is, I think, what we have in many cases today.
I think that's interesting. I remember doing this exercise years ago. Leah Bewley was doing a workshop at one of our conferences, and I sat in on this exercise where she was having people sketch ideas for a product. And she had pages that had 6 little phone-sized screens you know, sheets of paper on them, six ups. And she was saying, okay, I want you to spend just a minute or two on a version of the screen that you're working on, and then I want you to just draw it over again and just keep drawing it over and over again. But then she would say, you know, she'd say, okay, this time try it as if everything was done only with list boxes. And now try it as if everything was done with drag and drop. Now, how would you do it if it was a touch interface? Now, how would you do it if it was full body motion? What would the interactions be like Kinect, right? And she kept changing the inspiration. And I'm wondering if that's what you do with these diaries. You sort of, you pull out these things, you say, oh, well, what if I took this current thing I'm working on and I made it like this one thing that's in the folder, you know, that uses, you know, sort by agony. Does that make sense?
That makes complete sense. In fact, I do the same thing with all of my regular website web app work, where I think a frequent question I use is, you know, if I was a five-year-old, does this UI make sense? And that's a great one, because five-year-olds are just starting to read, but they don't have a high tolerance for lots of text. I know Russ Unger's used the opposite. He says, you know, would my great-grandmother, would this make sense to her? We're working on a very complex page right now where there's lots of real estate needed at the company I'm at. You know, we did the challenge, the mobile first thing. If this was a mobile interface, how would that work? And just throwing in this really ridiculous constraint for our need, which, you know, we were having trouble with a 1024 by 768 sort of browser dimension. So let's make it even worse and see if that, you know, forces us to abandon the ideas we have and come up with something new. And I think that's the whole goal of these exercises, is to get out of how you're seeing things currently and see it from an entirely different perspective. I've even seen the same exercise done with very strong brands. So you might look at the same, you know, web app, for example, and say, okay, if Apple is designing this, how would this look? And that's, I think, where most of us tend to gravitate these days. But then change it and say, okay, if Disney was designing this very same time tracking app, how would Disney design it? Or if Virgin America, you know, Richard Branson was designing this, how would he design it? If the team behind World of Warcraft designed this time tracking app, how would they do it? What you're doing in the process, whether it's through a constraint or this role, is you're being forced to change your perspective and see things in a different way. That's a fundamental idea that I think can apply to any creative challenge.
So a lot of designs involve large amounts of data, right? You know, the airline and hotel stuff that we've talked about, choosing a TV, you know, the projects we work on have sales data, or I don't know, teacher data or student data or whatever the data is, right? And the knee-jerk reaction for all of that stuff was basically, let's just put everything into a big table.
Mm-hmm. Tables are easy.
Tables are easy.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, and there's any number of table widgets that you can get. So it makes coding easy. And it's sort of like, well, let's put it in the table and we'll figure it out later.
Yes, I see. Because I work primarily with web applications, I tend to come in before any other designer has touched it, or it's been primarily an engineering team. No offense to engineers out there, but engineers love their tables. It seems to be the default way to publish information to the page.
Well, it reflects the schema, right? I mean, it's, you know, each row is an element of the database, a piece of data, and each column is a field for that element. And so it just naturally works.
It works. It's a mirror reflection of how the database is set up, which is the problem, because a lot of people don't think like a database thinks. The people building this do, but not the people oftentimes who have to use these systems. And I've seen crazy things, I'm sure you've seen as well, where it's not even a lot of data. Maybe by the time it's published to the page, it's one or two rows with maybe 10 columns. And you look at this, you're like, that's an odd way, or, you know, to publish this to the page when it's a one row, you know, data table, right? And you see these things all the time in the early stages of these products. I was given a talk last week in Bulgaria, giving a talk on micro moments and this, these tiny interactions that I think we've talked about before. And I was critiquing Dropbox and the way they showed my, you know, I renewed my Dropbox subscription for the year. And, you know, where the page should have said, you know, give me a simple receipt and said, yep, you're paid up using this credit card in these numbers. And, you know, here's what you paid for. I got this six row data grid that, I mean, I had to read through, and sure, all the information was there, but they could have said it in a much more succinct way. And so I made an offhand comment about tables and, you know, not always the best way to serve information to the user. And at the end of it, I got a Q&A from someone saying, hey, you know, basically, what's your beef with tables? And so my first question back to them was, all right, do you happen to be an engineer? And he was like, well, yeah. And I was like, okay. But the theme out of that was make sure you know your audience. So even in the visualization talks, I'm really careful to say, look, if your audience is engineers, at the end of the day, don't take away the table from them. Don't take away the CSV file. This is what they like. This is power in many ways. But if, and this is the more often the case, if your audience is not engineers or not sales jockeys, another term I use for these salespeople who love their Excel spreadsheets and macros and all, if that's not your audience, then you probably need to think about other ways to show or surface the information. Because, you know, grids and rows and columns, these are just not how we naturally think.
Well, my theory, you can tell me if you agree with this or not. My theory is that a lot of times things end up in tables because no one's thinking about how will the data be used. And so the thought is, well, it's cheap to code a table and it gets all the data visible. And then we'll put it out there and see how it's used and then we can redo it. But then nobody ever goes back to see how it's used. So it just stays in that table.
That is, you hit the nail on the head. That's exactly what I see over and over again. It is the easy way. It's the path of least resistance and it leaves you the freedom to come back later and tailor it. The question is, do you actually set aside or prioritize the time to do that? And, you know, it's this tension between prioritizing for use and the experience and usability and prioritizing for new features that we see all the time.
I almost wonder if there's some way we can start programming teams such that when they see a table or when they have the urge to use a table, you know, maybe it's when they insert the code to use a table, something pops up and says, are you sure there's not a better way to do this?
I would love that. Let's build that plugin and ship it to code editors everywhere.
Yeah. What are some alternatives to tables that you've seen recently that are actually pretty slick? I mean, the HipMunk swim lanes is a great way to do flight data. And what's interesting about that is that it has multiple dimensions. It has a start time and end time for the entire flight, so you get to see the duration of the entire flight. It has the start and end of each leg. It has the layover, which is neat because when it's big enough, they can insert the city in it. They're color coding for the airline. They show relative to time, so you can see the early flights or the later flights. One of the things for me is that I never like to take the last flight out, right? Because if, like yesterday, I was flying out of Miami, there were thunderstorms. And if I was on the last flight, I would have never gotten home because my connections would have been totally screwed up. I had managed to get an earlier flight and it still took me an extra 3 hours to get home, but I made it. And I've learned that the last flight is the one that is the most risky. So I always take at least the second to last flight. And I can look at HipMunk and immediately tell what's the last flight and what's the second to last flight. And I just know which one I want to go with. Whereas in a table, that's really hard to sort through.
Oh, absolutely. I've done the same thing on these international flights where there's a layover. And knowing sometimes that the first flight might be delayed for whatever reason, and you know, for a 10-hour international flight after that, for the second leg, you don't want to miss that. So I'll actually look and say, okay, if there's a problem, like if this first flight's delayed, does this airport, you know, is there other backups, other options, or is that the one flight that's going out of? Yeah, sites like HipMunk really help you see that right away.
What are some other examples you've come across recently that are alternatives to just tables of data?
I don't know if you recall, but the earliest version of this conversation, this talk that I gave, I actually had pointed out the problems I was having with my long distance data plans. Whenever I travel internationally and turn on the data plans, I'd come home and I'd get double billed. So I'd get billed for the amount I was paying, you know, the 100, 200 megabytes I had paid for, but then they would bill me for all the data usage as if I had not paid for that 200 megabyte plan. And I'd get on the phone and, you know, we'd have to go through line by line, work it out. And, you know, it was always in my favor, the errors, and they say, oh yeah, you know, we owe you money. But in that talk, I just did a quick visualization. I think it took an hour in keynote just to mock up, you know, here's a great way for me to actually track and monitor my actual data usage to see if I'm going over or under. And I even accounted for things like prorating. So if you're paying for 2 weeks because you're only traveling for a week, but you know you need maybe half of the 200 megs. Yeah, I got into the details on this. Here's a simple visual way that you could look at it on your mobile phone, just get an idea of if you're going over or under, if you need to keep an eye on your data usage. And I was looking at a friend's Android phone last year, and he said, hey, check this out. And he showed me pretty much something in line with what I had sketched, you know, kind of some curves and a line sort of showing your average usage. And it was pretty much the visualization that communicated what, you know, dozens of lines of data in a grid in my cell phone bill never did. And so that's one example I've seen. That one I have to grin at because it was very similar to what I had sketched in that presentation. I'm trying to think, I'm going out to Mountain View a lot these days. And so I'm, you know, flying into San Francisco and taking the Caltrain down to Mountain View. And, you know, I don't live in San Francisco, so I don't know all the trains like people who live there do. But, you know, there are some, the bullet trains, whatever, that will not stop at certain stops, but they get places much faster, and others that stop at every stop. I think there are three different train lines. I can't remember the exact URL for this, but I found this visual to all of the Caltrain, you know, rails and all the stops. And you basically choose northbound, southbound, and then going across, it has the time of day. And then you can kind of see all the stops, these little dots on the line. It's hard to describe in words, but when you see it, it's like, oh yeah, there are the trains and that's the one I need to take. And it's interactive. You can hover over it and get the details for when you need to grab a particular train to arrive at, you know, back in SFO or back in San Francisco at the appropriate time. So that one was really nice. And I've seen other people deal with this in data, but being able to actually see it through these lines and dots on a graph, that was actually much more useful to see it in that visual way.
Google Maps has a new interface for their public transit directions that show, basically it's HipMunk similar, but it shows you like which piece you have to walk and then which piece you ride on, and you can see when the different trains leave. It's really cool looking. Again, it's a swim lane type approach. So if there's, you know, you could take a bus or you could take the train or you could just walk it. They compare those all side by side on a time scale.
Is that in the desktop version or is that on the
mobile? It's in the desktop version.
I'll have to check that out. Usually I'm pulling up transit directions on my phone, so I've probably missed out on that one.
Yeah. If you go to Maps and then you like try and find your way around New York or San Francisco and use the public transit options, it's actually pretty cool.
Yeah, living in Dallas, we're pretty spread out, and unless you have a car, you're kind of out of luck. So
right. Yeah, so I don't know what you talk of this public transit thing.
Yeah.
That's my Dallas accent, by the way.
Okay.
It's sort of Dallas Russian.
Yeah, you need to throw in a y'all in there.
Y'all, I don't know what you talk of this Russian y'all.
So I'll tell you where I'd love a visualization, something. I have more and more books now on my Kindle app for the iPad. And also I have a mix because my wife and I share an account. You know, there's the books she downloads, there's the books I download. And then there's the overlap, the books we both enjoy reading. But, you know, it'd be really nice, like in the real world, just to be able to arrange my books like on a bookshelf or even just folders or groups of some sort. But I think all I have is sort by author and sort by title. Yeah, even things like when I go online and I'm pushing in a few new books or samples of new books, I want to go in and look at that, and there's no place where the new books can show up. Instead, I have to look for this flag for new. And so if you have more than 100 books, you're scrolling through looking for that little flag that says new or sample or whatever it may be. So, you know, something that was more like, you know, arranging books on the bookshelf like we do in real life would be really helpful about now, just to start to organize all the books we have in the Kindle app.
Yes.
Maybe someone from Amazon's listening and maybe they're working on that right now.
Please, now, fix. Yes, I'm there.
Yeah, there's another one. It's a very small, it's not a rich data example, but it's really helpful. I use a time tracking app called Freckle. I think the URL is letsfreckle.com. But when you enter your data, it's actually represented back to you on this kind of a month view calendar. And rather than put in numbers and things, they actually have this pie chart. And if you only have one project, then it's not really a pie chart. It's just a round circle. And the size of the circle is the relative time that you put in that day. So if you put in 3 hours, the circle is going to be smaller than if you put in 8 hours.
So. Oh, neat.
And then the other thing that's great about it is if you do have multiple projects, then it's actually a pie wedge and you can see different colors for the different types of projects. And again, the scale for the hours and the wedges for the different projects. And it's a really nice visual way.
Oh, yeah. So the size of the dot still changes based on the hours?
Yep.
Oh, and that makes sense why it's called Freckle, because I guess they all look like little freckles.
There you go.
That's very clever.
It's a great visual way to see your time. And also, a very small thing, but I point out, let's say it's Tuesday afternoon, I'm entering my time for Tuesday, and I entered it yesterday for Monday, and as I hit submit, I see that Monday circle get twice as big, but there's nothing in the Tuesday circle. It's an instant visual feedback loop. And so I can say, oh, I had my date wrong. I just added 7 hours to Monday when I meant to add it to Tuesday. And that's happened probably 3 or 4 times over the past. And just because of that visual cue, I was able to correct the error. And so that's another thing I like to point out is when you use visual things, we're more likely to be able to spot and then fix the errors versus, you know, if it just added a row or a line that said, oh yeah, you added entered 7 hours on Monday, I wouldn't have noticed probably. Just our sense of vision, we pick up these little details and these subtle changes of all our organs. Sense organs, it's the most highly developed one. So little changes like that in size, scale. You'll notice games, like I'm playing this horribly addictive game that my wife got me onto called Candy Crush. I think it's kind of popular right now. It's kind of like another form of Bejeweled in many ways. But as you're getting lower and you're running out of turns, it has a counter for all your turns. But as soon as it gets to 5 or lower, it starts blinking and kind of swelling. And even though it's really small, it's a really tiny dot, like your eye catches it and it adds to the anxiety and the tension. But you see it, just that little bit of animation. Again, because we're attuned to pick up those subtle visual changes.
Cool. Well, Stephen, this has been awesome. I can't wait till your workshop at UI18.
Oh, I am looking forward to it.
It's going to be great. It'd be fun to learn how to create these things and use them. So everyone, you need to go to uiconf.com, uiconf.com, and look up Stephen's full-day workshop on displaying data in digestible ways, because it's going to be a fabulous way to sort of take your applications and designs to the next level. And it's just, as you can tell, Stephen is a joy to listen to, and he's so smart. Steve, thank you so much for being part of this.
Thank you, Jared.
And I want to once again thank our audience for listening in and taking part. And we love to hear your thoughts. Send us your thoughts on our UIE blog. We love to hear what you have to say at uie.com. And please let us know what we could do differently. That brings us to the end of today. I want to thank you for listening and thank you for encouraging our behavior. And we'll talk to you again next time. Take care.
For more information, visit uiconf.com. That's uiconf.com. As always, thank you for listening.